Welcome to Measured Impact, where we share behind-the-scenes stories of the world's leading mission-driven companies. Because when it comes to activism, brand building, and revenue growth, we believe profits and purpose aren't mutually exclusive. Let's dive in. All right, today on Measured Impact, we are joined by Charlie Clark, the Director of Philanthropy for Cotopaxi, an outdoor company behind the Gear for Good promise. Cotopaxi is a certified B Corp and a public benefit corporation that uses its business to support communities experiencing poverty. Through the Cotopaxi Foundation, the company distributes at least 1% of annual revenue through grants to nonprofit partners working across health, education, livelihoods, and humanitarian response. Charlie helps lead the foundation's grant-making strategy and operations, bringing experience from across outdoor, philanthropy, and the nonprofit sectors. And today we're talking about how purpose-led brands can fund social change responsibly, use data without losing context, and turn good intentions into measurable impact. Charlie, welcome.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Neil. Super excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I like to start with an easy one. Tell us who you are, what your job title is, and where you live.
Ooh, I do know that. So, yep. My name is Charlie. I'm the Director of Philanthropy at Cotopaxi. That essentially means that I am running the Cotopaxi Foundation. So we do a lot of stuff that we would put under the umbrella of impact. One of them is philanthropy and poverty alleviation. And so that is my purview. I live in Portland, Oregon. Lived here for now, 6 years, 2020. And I grew up here. So it's been fun coming back and getting back into the food scene and everything. And I started working for Cotopaxi in 2021 as a contractor. And now here we are.
So for those who are less familiar, what would we know Cotopaxi as?
Yeah, I mean, I would say the number one thing is you probably know them as the super colorful, color-blocked bags that you see at the airport. That's like the number one thing I get that comments on. But if you dig a little bit deeper, you would know us as the do-good brand. So we've a lot of incredible outdoor brands who do so much great work, but the do good tagline is slapped across a lot of our stuff, and it covers a lot of things. I mean, we focus on our internal folks, kind of that people first mentality. The company itself was started back in 2014 as a vehicle for positive social change. It was our founder, Davis Smith, grew up in Ecuador and saw a lot of need there and knew that he wanted to create something that was an engine for change that would impact folks beyond what he was able to just like give personally over his lifetime. So I don't think he knew what he wanted to make. He just knew he wanted to start a brand, start a company, and that could turn into a movement and that could fuel change. So we are the outdoor brand who kind of meets you where you are. You know, we're not the ones pushing you up Everest, or you're not going to grab our stuff and go red point the first, amazing thing you see. But we want everyone to be able to easily access the outdoors, be able to access adventure travel, get out, see the world, but then also make it better, right? So you're experiencing new places, new things, challenging yourself, but challenging yourself by meeting someone new, learning something new, eating something that you've never eaten before. And then also when you're in that place, whether it's your neighborhood park or somewhere across the globe, you are also giving back in some way, giving your energy, your time, that kind of thing, and then sharing your experiences.
So give me a feel for you personally. How did you get into sort of the philanthropy side of stuff or the impact side? What sort of brought you into that space?
Yeah, totally. So, a little bit of a winding path, as I'm sure a lot of us have. After college, I just bummed around a little bit in the outdoor industry, working at gear shops and guiding and that kind of thing, and had a pretty obviously strong connection to the places that I was recreating in and that I loved, and for the beauty, for the ecological importance, for how connected they were to the communities that I was in. And then after a while, I kind of realized like maybe get a little bit more serious about things and realized that I think where I wanted to be was in a position where I could help conserve these places and kind of bring more to the forefront the connection that they have between health of communities, but then also just like general societal health and fun. So I was just kicking around trying to figure out what to do. Like, what does that mean? Do I, you know, I love nature documentaries. Does that mean I have to go back and become a biologist? I'm terrible at math. Like, what? I felt stuck. So I was looking around. At the time, I was working for Patagonia, a great, you know, great competitor of ours, but also a great partner in, you know, industry coalitions and that kind of thing. I mean, I think everyone's very familiar with their very robust advocacy and funding efforts. Their conservation efforts are legendary, very well known. But I feel like less people know that they do the same thing at a local level. So I was working at the local Seattle store, and they have a grant making program, local grant making, where they give each store some money and then local organizations can apply. And being a part of that process was incredible. And I think that was when it kicked off. And I was like, oh, working with these people are so passionate. They're so brilliant. And they have the drive that I feel like I could really see myself getting into this line of work. And so looked around, it turned out right in my own backyard, Seattle University offered a master's in nonprofit leadership. So long story short, went there. At the time, I was just kind of like white guy doing white guy conservation stuff. Being in that program was a huge wake-up call and an incredible time for me. They had zero focus on environmental sustainability, conservation, or anything. It was almost exclusively social justice and equity-focused coursework, along with the kind of, you know, standard, almost MBA-like how to run an organization, et cetera. And met some incredible people in that program. And I think I learned a lot as well about the interconnectedness between you know, oppressed communities, underserved communities, the conservation through line that I wanted to take through, and just the links there. So then it kind of became, I was like, oh, okay, I've been thinking about this as just like, let's conserve empty land so we can go play on it. But then I think my world was expanded a little bit. Got to work with some really incredible nonprofits at that point too on different projects. And at the time, I was working for a now partner of Cotopaxi's called Mir, another great brand, doing some really cool social impact work. And kind of as soon as I graduated from that program, got to work on that company's grant making program and build that out a little bit, and met Annie Eagle, who's the VP of Sustainability and Impact here at Cotopaxi. Met her through a Mir Cotopaxi partnership. And when I left Mir, sent out the email saying, hey, you know, I'm off on my own. She immediately emailed me back and was like, at Cotopaxi, we've got so much going on, so much impact work that I could really use a second pair of hands. And that's a medium length version of it. I could go shorter. I could probably go longer, but you don't want me to.
Awesome. Well, let me hear kind of your thoughts on, you know, your personal journey. Was clearly you were motivated to decide to do some good at some point, right? Like whenever that switch was made for you, I'm curious, was it chance or intention or, you know, circumstance that sort of led you to thinking about having your own personal impact via a brand and a for-profit business rather than working out directly with a nonprofit? Or how did you get to where you are today? And how did you start thinking about that?
Yeah, that's a really great question. Growing up, my mom worked for a nonprofit, like a family mediation nonprofit. So she was involved in some pretty tough situations in terms of like looking at families having a rough go of it. And so I kind of saw, in addition to that, watching her work through these like really, really challenging moments, things at work. And then also her team, her organization, having to also then fundraise for their jobs while they're dealing with this really, really intense work. And then on the backside of that, not getting paid all that much for all of the incredible work, the brilliant stuff that they were doing. I think that was maybe like the first seed of just being like, wow, I feel like there could be a better way to do things when these people are kind of giving so much of themselves. And then the opportunity to go through that program, learn kind of the ins and outs of fundraising within the program, but then also the just like connecting with the people who are doing all of this stuff. I was just like, it seems like the funder nonprofit relationship is so... Not always. This is a generalization, but it it's broken in a lot of ways. And at the time I was working for this brand, Mir, that it, their thing was very, very similar to Cotopaxi's. It's, you know, a percentage of revenue going to social impact and environmental impact programming. And I saw that if I'm lucky enough to be in this funder seat, then I can take everything that I have learned while working for nonprofits, you know, worked for one just out of school, and everything I learned from, you know, growing up watching my mom, plus everything that I've learned from these incredible professors that were active in the industry, brought in to teach us, as well as my my cohort of students. I can be a better funder. I can try and set an example for how corporate giving can be better than a greenwashing, you know, marketing pitch. It can be better than even the best intentioned ones. And I wanted to take all the learnings and then parlay them into better relationships with nonprofits, trying to make sure that it is beyond like best practices for funding, but best practices for receiving the funds and making that loop a true partnership and not just a transactional relationship, I think.
Yeah, it sounds like your lived experience sort of aligned a little bit with sort of what you were seeing in the space.
Yeah, that and the lived experiences of others that I was learning from, I think, is a big part of it too. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm curious, as you know, we talk about Cotopaxi. From my understanding, your philanthropic efforts and a lot of your impact work is through the Cotopaxi Foundation. Give us a feel for just like the setup. What does your team look like? You mentioned Angie. How do you guys sort of interact with the brand? And I think one of the reasons we talk about this is a lot of the folks that we are talking to, both on this podcast and conversations we're having, the setups are kind of different at every brand, yeah. Right? Like how close together the brand marketers are to the philanthropic folks, to the impact people, to the people doing the work. So give us a feel on what that looks like at Cotopaxi.
Yeah, great question. I mean, it is. And in talking to industry colleagues and stuff, and things look so different, even though we're doing very similar work sometimes, sometimes not, but it's fascinating to look across different brands and see how things are set up. So the way that we look at impact in the broadest sense is we've got kind of do good / whatever impact at the very top. Then Annie and I kind of bifurcate it. She's in charge of our impact generally, but what she focuses on is sustainability, decarbonization, and climate. So looking at like materials sustainability, and then also supply chain sustainability, supply chain human rights, and just kind of like our high level governance as well. And then I am focused 100% on the nonprofit relationships, the philanthropy, and the poverty alleviation work. Those are our two biggest buckets of impact. I think we also would say that our the work with our employees, our people is one part of that as well. And then we are the only two people who actually work on the impact team. Annie works obviously so closely with our product development team, our product teams, our people team. I mean, when you're talking about material sourcing and sustainability, they are incredible partners for her. And then I work very, very closely with also our brand team, because one of the things I think, and you probably, I mean, you're a storyteller, we're on this podcast right now. One of the most important things about impact in general is actually being able to then share the story of what's actually happening. I mean, you can look at it in a lot of different ways. Numbers can tell a story for sure. You can also go more of a qualitative route and focus on an individual who has been changed by a certain program or an intervention. But I work very closely with those folks to bring what we're doing to life. And it's a, you know, I think, especially in this industry, it's a tricky line to walk. You know, we're selling products, right? They are expensive because they are really well made, really thoughtfully designed, and you know, they're for a purpose. I mean, people love them, people use them all the time. We can repair them; they're fantastic. And you know, how do you juxtapose that with the work that the foundation is doing, working with our partners who are working with communities experiencing extreme poverty? You know, that often can be a hard tension to look at in a marketing email or something like that. So really, really grateful for my partnership with our brand team, who is so understanding, you know, in terms of what is best practices, how to talk about vulnerable populations, how to talk about the work, spotlight our partners, not just like, oh, Cotopaxi does this, Cotopaxi does that. We're so great. But really, truly focusing on the people who are doing the work. So I would say that's sort of, you know, there's only two of us on the team specifically, but we each have really, really important partners within the brand who are helping our initiatives come to life, both internally and externally.
So in that sense, it sounds like for you guys, like most sort of mission-driven brands, the storytelling element of it becomes core function of being able to get the message out. So I'm curious, as you guys are thinking about developing those stories, whether they're qualitative or it's quantitative and you're making infographics talking about change or whatever it is, right? Like, how do you look at measuring the amount of folks who are impacted in some way by that story or exposed to that story? Or how do you measure the response to sort of say, hey, this thing seemed to really connect with our audience, maybe a little bit better than this other story, right? Like from a more traditional storytelling element, how do you guys think about gauging whether or not something really resonated with your audience?
That's a great question. And if you have someone who has the perfect answer, please let me know. I think mainly I'd say that just because we are always having this conversation and I don't think there is an end, you know, it's just like, how can we improve on capturing whether it's consumer sentiment or insights on what, you know, did or didn't hit with audiences. I mean, I think the most basic level, just who and how many people are engaging with this story versus that story. We have a series called Mission Monday. So every Monday we will go out with some story on an impact story. So whether that is focusing on a partner's program or project that has completed and it's a celebration of that completion, or a new initiative that we're focusing on with, you know, cleaner chemicals, something like that. Some sort of story that lives in our impact kind of wheelhouse. And we will monitor the response and engagement to those posts. And so we do have a sense of what our audience is engaging the most with. And I think that we, over the years, have done more pointed sort of like customer insight and stakeholder insight surveys and materiality assessments, that kind of thing. And it is interesting. It's not always what you might think is resonating is the actual thing that people are really, really into. I think it's interesting to us, the whole philanthropy and poverty alleviation, that's the reason that the company was started. It is one of the core kind of hallmarks of our impact program, but the average consumer does not know us for that. And it's like maybe the fourth thing they think of when you mention Cotopaxi. The bright color is the number one, then it might be sustainable fabric or something, or maybe under bright color, then it's just do good. You know, they know that message. And then the sustainability of like our Dead Stack fabric program, our Del Dia line, which it's incredible. We've got new things coming every day from that line. And that was kind of the line that really gained us some notoriety and people saw it. It's hard to miss, actually. But then that poverty alleviation piece, unless you specifically dig down a little bit deeper or follow us very closely, I think the average consumer isn't engaging with those stories quite as much for some reason. So that is something like we've got some kind of fresh brand and marketing energy in the last 6 months, some new leadership and some teams are being built out in a way that's pretty exciting. I think some new structures that we've had. So we are actually now in a position to start measuring a little bit of this even more than we have in the past. So, you know, maybe we'll follow up in a year, 6 months or something, and I'll let you know what we've learned since then. But it is it's a slow process. A lot of time and energy we want to spend on how do we grow the business. And so we're doing insights on that, like product specific insights. But then we also know that we've got to bring this side along with it.
So I guess my question that you sort of teed up for me is if, say, 80% of your customer base is unaware of your core mission, is that a problem?
Yeah, I would say yes and no. I think, again, there's a couple ways you could look at it, I suppose. I think the core of the company, if the only thing anyone ever knew about the company is that we were mission-driven, we have values that people align with, and that they could feel really good and very comfortable and like they were even maybe making a difference by purchasing something that we make, I think at the end of the day, that would be a win. You know, like if so many companies kind of, they have their core brand and then they tack on an impact thing on the side and you might see that campaign or something like that. But then that's not what you're thinking about when you look at that brand. But if when people see our brand, if they think about vibrancy and positive impact, like that's good with me. My job, I'm the nerd. You know, Annie and I like to joke that we're the like subject matter nerds. If I know in my heart that what we're doing is creating real, measurable, metrics-backed impact somewhere in the world and real communities are being lifted out of poverty, I'll take that all day if our company is also growing. Our next frontier is, where is the breakdown? Or where is that disconnect? And then how do we bridge it? And I think I mentioned, you know, maybe this is just like a cop-out of an answer, but this new structure we're building on our brand team, the focus for the next, I mean, just ongoing into the future, but really for this next 6 months is how do we better integrate that story in a way that there's really some, an entry point for every type of customer. Are you the person who just saw us because we launched a new, you know, new paid ads on Instagram or TikTok and you just are like, whoa, they do good? Or are you the person who wants to dig down a little bit deeper? Do you want to look at individual human stories that we're pulling from Latin America or one of the groups who work here in the US? Or do you want to see exactly what chemicals we're using because we got rid of the PFAS stuff and you want like all of that information should be available to whoever wants to go as deep as they want to go. But how do you make it so all of that stuff is digestible, maybe sort of fun? You know, you're looking at a tax document and you're, you know, trying to find the small print. Like we want to make it available and we want to make it digestible. And so that's sort of our that's going to be the challenge of the next little bit here is integrating everything in a way, because there's so much. I think that's one of our problems too. It's like there is so much and how do we bring it out to the right audience at the right time?
Do you have a sense that on your team, maybe it's on the brand team, maybe it's on the leadership team, like is the commitment to doing good, right? It's core of who you guys are. But I also sense just in the way you describe all that, there's like a true sense that also by doing good, we'll probably actually sell some more stuff and people will like our products more and people will be more committed to our brand. Do you have any way to know if that's actually happening or it's happening more or less, or is your brand, whatever brand equity, brand affinity, brand loyalty, like, do you guys have any tangible numbers or metrics that allow you to look at like, hey, yeah, like we told these stories and we create this good product and those combinations together mean this, here's what we're seeing, the growth is up, or this is how this activism or this impact work is impacting people's relationship with our brand. Like, is there a numeric or a measurable way that you guys can digest that impact at all?
Yeah, great question. I'm not the best person to answer that for you, just because that would be some of our, the folks who are more focused on, you know, like brand promotion and that kind of thing. However, I do know there's a couple things that we do look at for sure. And there's also like, there are other, you know, there are bigger companies that have studies that definitely show, and I'm not talking about like brands, but, you know, research groups, think tanks and that kind of thing that do show that, you know, especially people of a certain like age group, if there are two comparable products, they're more likely to buy one that aligns with their values, whether that is conservation minded. I mean, you can look at Patagonia's entire arc and see some of that. One thing that we do know is as we grow as a company, we have an extremely high net promoter score of consumers. So once a consumer comes in and buys something of ours, they will not just maybe purchase again, which is great, we'll take it, but they are actually actively broadening the Cotopaxi community through their own social posts. We get so much re-engagement with like a product comes out and kind of like, oh my God, I've had mine for so long, this is incredible. Like, and then people, you know, you can see that through line. So the net promoter score and those types of things, like the loyalty scores are very high. And then our unaided awareness, that's the number where we're like, gosh, there's so much growth here. Like we are barely scratching the surface. you know, we're big in certain states. We've got a lot of the West Coast, you know, we're pretty well known there. But there's so many conversations I have that I never go in assuming people know who we are, just because I've had both sides where I'll say Cotopaxi, it's a, and everyone's like, oh yeah, God, are you kidding me? I love it. I have so many pieces. And then other people, you know, if I'm talking to a lot of people from like the Southeast or the Midwest, where we don't have a lot of retail locations and we're newer, then it's more of a conversation. But yes, we do have different metrics that tell us that once people know the brand, know the mission, they tend to stick with us for, you know, the remainder of their outdoor gear buying lives. And then we go with that, also those broader industry looks at mission-driven companies and that choice factor.
Yeah, it's a really neat way to think about, you know, how you guys are balancing that. You're doing a lot of things, it seems like, across the activism and the impact side. So I guess one of the questions that I have, you guys reported, you know, that you've reached millions of people through poverty alleviation work. How do you know that? How do you measure
great
that?
Question.
How are you?
Great question.
How is that not a glamour metric? That?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is another point. So I mentioned a little while back, giving our grantee partners the credit, spotlighting them. We aren't the ones on the ground doing the work with communities, so we want to make sure that the credit goes to our partners. We also trust our partners a great deal. I wouldn't say we ascribe to every single tenet of it, but there's a practice called trust-based philanthropy. If you're not familiar with it, head to the Trust-Based Philanthropy Project. It's an incredible group. It's sort of kind of rethinking the way that funders and, you know, grantees work together, and putting kind of the onus on funders to lower the barriers to actually creating real impact on the ground. So when you think about it, you know, it's the kind of thing with lowering barriers to like paperwork barriers. Do we have a 50-page proposal that's going to, you know, cause a full-time headcount to spend 3 weeks just focusing on that, when that full-time headcount could have actually been doing work that actually created real impact? That kind of thing, you know, making your funding unrestricted, right? So it's like, if we just said you can only buy shovels with this $50,000 so that you can dig the line for this new clean water pipeline, and then great, we bought $5,000 worth of shovels. Now, what do we do? Are we going to just rebuy them when they break? Or are we going to be able to use that to then pivot to something? Oh, there's something in the project that we didn't realize was going to happen. We have to shore up this concrete pad because, you know, there was a landslide. Well, we can't use that money from Cotopaxi for that. So I guess we're stuck and this project stalled, right? So like that kind of thing, you would never you've founded multiple businesses, right? If a customer was paying you and they were like, here, thank you for this service, here's this money that we owe you, and you can only use it for the desks.
You can buy office. Paper you'd with
like,
this stuff.
Yeah, you'd be like, that's insane. I don't want to run a business like that. And nonprofits don't want to run their businesses like that or their organizations. So,
as someone who's chaired the board of a couple of nonprofits in the past, what I would say is that my understanding today is if you do that for a little while, right? Like if you're in that space, in the nonprofit space for any amount of time, the more likely you are to say like, hey, you got to find the groups who are doing good and then give them what they need and get the hell out of the way. Right.
Yeah.
And
right. Yes. Right.
You know, our adage, the most recent one was a group called I Am Able Foundation. And we did sort of adaptive equipment grants for athletes who had, you know, whether they're cognitive or physical disability. And, you know, we could get so many people to support buying a physical piece of equipment, right? $10,000 cycle, right? But what we really need is people to support $10 classes, adaptive fitness classes, and, yeah, you know, coaches and teachers and all the things, right? And one of the things we took on was the idea that if we could tell those stories a little bit better, it can make people,
yeah,
have a way to connect with it. And in some cases, basically just saying like the whole adage of everybody wants to fund a school, but nobody wants to pay a teacher. I think in this space, both in the nonprofit side and also in the activism side, if your customers don't understand what and how you're going to be using these funds in a way that is collaborative and impactful, then I feel like you end up defaulting to, and so we raised money for the United Way and we did, you know, this kind of more genericized impact. And I think at some level, like there's a creativity that's required to be able to tell stories well that people can get behind,
yeah,
and help them understand that, yes, like it's easy to say we need to build 3 miles of new clean water infrastructure, but if you can tell a story about how access to clean water has changed a village or changed a school or changed a thing, then I think people are a little less precious about where their money is going, right? Like, how can we support? We just want to support the end result. And if you can't tell the end result, if you can't illustrate it, it's really hard for people to get behind it. So then they default to, well, you need some shovels, right?
Exactly. And I mean, it's, I do remember the through line, so I'll get back to where I was going with that, but it is way less sexy to say we funded a training that went over 3 weeks and included, you know, paying five trainers to visit.
There's 24 bagels provided at lunch. And
exactly. And it's like all these little things, they matter so much when you could say like, we were the ones who built that school or something like that. So part of trusting our partners to do the work that they're doing and the shared accountability is also trusting them to report what they're doing, right? In a pretty, you know, we want there to be trust. We want them to have the flexibility to fund what they really need to fund to create the change that they're working on. But we're still asking what's happening, right? And we, you know, we don't always get to visit every site personally, but we've been to Ecuador looking at the projects that our partners are doing, likely getting ahead to Guatemala, where there's another cluster of nonprofits that we're working with. And so we are using their very robust reporting that's already in place. I mean, we're not the only funders that they have. Many of their funders do require much more rigorous reporting. And so we oftentimes will reap those rewards. They already have, metrics on all their KPIs set up for another funder, and they will give that to us. I think so much of what we do is making sure we do homework up front so that we're not nitpicking along the way. So making sure we know what their success metrics are, and at the very beginning when we start the relationship, and saying like, oh yes, those work for us too. So we know, and with our research backed kind of like the tenets that we follow, you know, trust-based philanthropy is one part, but we only fund things that have been proven to actually lift full communities out of poverty. Thus, those, you know, education, livelihoods, and healthcare pillars, getting those from the UN Foundation, also MIT's Poverty Action Lab, tons of research over decades. So we know the types of interventions that we're going to fund beforehand. We know they're going to work if they're executed properly. And the organizations that we work with this year, based on 2025, our partners reported over 200,000 people were reached through the programming. But really, that number through our grant making system aggregated all of the people that they actually reported. It was probably north of 300,000. But based on what I felt was reasonable for what we actually fund, we cut it down to more specific numbers so that we are under actually probably reporting the total people who are being reached, and focusing in more on like who actually was receiving an intervention directly or indirectly, but really receiving a benefit. So yeah, leaning on those partners for a lot of things, that's another part of that two-way street.
So I'm curious for you guys, you've sort of been at Cotopaxi in an interesting 5 years or so, right? Like, I think it's politically the COVID of it all, post, you know, changes, elections. What has changed about how you, or you and Angie, or you and the Cotopaxi team think about having an impact in 2026 versus, like, I don't know, maybe 2023? Like, what's different?
Yeah.
Totally. And how have you guys sort of adapted?
That's a great question. And I think that there's a couple things. One, I think, is the collective action. I think that is a big piece. Probably a few years ago, we were pretty focused on what we wanted to do. There's that big pandemic boom a lot of industries, but the outdoor industry in particular, everyone was going outside because they couldn't go inside. So people were buying bikes and tents and gear and all that stuff.
Government money, man. Yeah, I got to spend it on something, and being around people.
Exactly. So, you know, we hired a ton of people. We were so like, this is it. This is the moment. This is our time to kind of grow this movement. And I think now, you know, that we've had a bit of an industry downturn. A lot of companies were laying people off after that COVID boom. I mean, people continue to do that, especially look at the tech industry and that kind of thing. But now we are shifting our mindset to say like, okay, maybe advocacy with this larger group of companies is the way to go. And that's on the maybe the company side. Public lands is an issue that we're getting with people with. We, you know, maybe post about it. We all as a group cared about it. But now, like, maybe let's join the swell at this point, or supply chain, human rights, that type of thing. And, you know, it's tough for a lot of companies now with extra logistics pressure of tariffs and that kind of thing. So working with other, you know, industry partners on, like, how do we work through this, navigate this kind of tough time for lots of brands and lots of manufacturers. And then for myself too, on the foundation side, same thing. I mean, it's different issues and different areas, but I'm kind of opening up a little bit and saying, like, okay, great. We can fund this one organization and watch their progress. And that's really exciting. And what if we actually zoomed out a little bit and looked around and we're like, okay, wait, who else is funding really cool projects, programs, coalitions, collectives in this either geographical area, issue area, whatever. And like, let's dial back. If our goal is to really have an actual, you know, the biggest, longest lasting impact, how do we partner with these people who either have been doing it longer, have been doing it better, or are just doing something slightly different that we could layer on top, and then it would be a stronger outcome in the end. So I think those two pieces, both in the philanthropy side and the business and advocacy side, we're realizing, like, hey, let's pull our heads up, let's look around, and let's partner.
Yeah, it seems like there's a shift. I wouldn't even say it's just you guys, even with some of the companies that we talked to recently or that we work with a lot, like this, there's an ego to, well, of course we can do it the best, right? And I think as soon as you take that assumption out, you say,
yeah,
who's going to have this impact? Who's already having an impact? And how do we accelerate theirs rather than try to build it from scratch? There's probably a way to see a more efficient investment of your energy and your efforts and your dollars when you're willing to sort of say, yeah, maybe we're not going to be the best people to actually do the thing, but we can still expand the thing, support the thing, all this stuff.
And like you said, it doesn't mean you can't be a leader in the space. You know, like, you can be a leader in saying, hey, we realized we're probably not the best, or we realize we can't do this alone. So like, join us, or like, let us join you, that kind of thing. Like, that's still, I think, all senses, that's leadership too, recognizing how you can serve a situation better.
All right. I'm going to hit some quick fire questions for you before we wrap for the day. So what brand or company do you look up to? And the answer can't be Patagonia, because that's not allowed.
Yeah, that's a good question.
And that could be at the personal level or at Cotopaxi. You know, who do you guys sort of aspire to have similar impact or structure or growth?
Oh, man. I feel like I should have a readier answer to this.
Happens a lot when I take Patagonia off the table, people, you know?
Right, right. I mean, I work for Patagonia. They're great. But I think, like, what I want is, like, a more niche one, you know, like a surprising one. Well, I'll give you two. How about that? I'll give a shout out to one of my kind of, like, industry colleagues. You may or may not be familiar with the company, but I guarantee you, you've used their products. World Centric. They make, like, compostable flatware. So if you've ever been to the grocery store and, you know,
yeah, it's the stuff at Whole Foods.
Got some plates. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know, you look at it and you're like, oh, great, compostable stuff. That's really cool. But they also have a super robust international develop and grant making program. They're just creating this impact because that's what they want to do. I think that's really admirable. There's another company called SALT, S-A-A-L-T, focuses on, I think they started with just women's menstrual products. And then they also were funding and providing materials for menstrual education in areas of the world experiencing poverty. So I just recently actually jumped onto their website, and they've expanded their product line a lot. The biggest things you can do to lift a community up is to fund the education of girls, support the livelihoods of women, and then they will then pour everything back into the surrounding community, which isn't necessarily the case for men. They tend to use money and resources on themselves if you look at generally what's going on. So if you can start a girl off, you know, receiving proper menstrual hygiene.
If only we had an example of this, like, playing out in the world from the Northwest, where, like, you had one person who was very, very rich, and then his wife, and they got divorced, and then she just gave all her money away very effectively, and he became a villain. If only we had that as an example.
Yeah, exactly. So they are just doing some incredible stuff. And the reason I bring them up is because I was like, whoa, I hadn't checked in a while, and they're growing. And I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that they had figured something out that's pretty special.
Next one is, what do you wish you could measure?
I mean, I'll keep it simple. I think one of the toughest things for us to measure is over long periods of time. So if you fund someone's education when they're, I don't know, middle school, elementary school, and you get them into a school and then they're able to lock in that spot and go through, what does that mean for them? Do they graduate? Post-graduation, are they going to a post-secondary? Then does that translate into a better career? I mean, there is data out there that says that, but us personally, I'm looking for the best way to do that. And really, I mean, time is probably the only thing, but it's also hard. I mean, you're tracking one kid in a specific area of the world all the way through until they get a career and have a family. That's nearly impossible, not impossible. But I think if I could figure out a way to do that on a large scale, that would be fantastic. Because that's the whole point. I mean, that is the whole point.
Yeah, the longevity of the impact is still a bit nebulous, I think, in a lot of cases. Yeah. What do you do to refill your tank?
Let's see. I mean, I feel like quick, easy answer is kids, but that's like a both. You know, you get a little up, a little down, but most of the time you fill in your tank with fun stuff with kids. I mean, I think like I said, the reason I got into this career in this line of work is just being in the outdoors. You know, my outdoor stuff is a little calmer now probably, but I like a good long, you know, backcountry backpacking trip solo. Just you stop thinking about any day-to-day stuff and you're just like, I need water. I need to find a safe tent site. I need to climb up there and then get back safely. And when all that melts away, I feel like everything, you know, fills back up.
What book or podcast do you find yourself recommending most to others?
Oh, that's a good one. I mean, I will say I'm a little embarrassed. I'm not a huge podcast person. And I feel like, you know, there's probably a couple of us out
give
there.
Give it a day or two, man. You might be soon. Who knows?
I mean, I'm a big fantasy sci-fi book reader. So I'll pitch a trilogy that I read last. It's called The Broken Earth Trilogy by N.K. Jemisin. Just really a super, super interesting take on kind of that fantasy sci-fi genre. It's like, you know, a departure from your very classic stuff, but there's still some really, really cool elements. But if there's any fantasy sci-fi readers out there, definitely check that trilogy out.
All right, last one. If I was coming to Portland, where would you send me to get the best sandwich?
Oh, man. You'd have to spend weeks in Portland for me to even start. But I can...
Yeah, I only get one, man. I only have time for my one sandwich. One. So where
then I'm okay. If you get, I mean, I grew up here, and if you only get one, I'm gonna send you to like the place I grew up going to. It's called Taste Tickler, and it is you get their steak Philly, which is like it's like a teriyaki, almost kind of like spicy teriyaki steak Philly on that like French baguette roll. God, it's been a while since I've been there. I need to go back. But that's where I'd send you, just because you see everywhere like the kind of like new popular Portland sandwich spots. But this is like true hole in the wall. They've been there since I was born kind of thing. So that's where I'd take you.
The heck of a name too.
That's solid.
One that withstands time. Well, Charlie, give me a feel for where people can find out more about you or about what you guys have going on at Cotopaxi.
Yeah, we've got some cool new stuff. I mean, we entered a whole new kind of product category. We've got an awesome new hard case roller. I cannot claim that is the most sustainable hard case roller out there, but it's designed with repairability in mind, all recycled materials on that case, super durable. And you can find that kind of stuff on Cotopaxi.com. You can
seeing the Token Bright Cotopaxi colorways in the airport? Like, is this what I'm going to be seeing? The roller bags?
So you know what
clearly...
you can do? We've got a couple nice colors. A couple of them are in black. We went pretty simple with the actual case, but the really, really smooth, awesome action wheels, you can swap them out. We've got tons of colors. So you can personally buy as many colors of the wheels as you want, mix and match them. So you do have that signature color in there. You can also find out too, we just released in the last few weeks our corporate impact report. So if you're interested in, you know, actually getting some of the numbers and interesting stuff behind any of the things I was saying, check out our website. And then in mid-June, our foundation will be releasing its annual report. So definitely more of that focus on the grantee partners and the philanthropy that we do.
Charlie Clark is the Director of Philanthropy at Cotopaxi, where he helps lead the foundation's grant-making strategy and operations. Charlie's held multiple impact-related roles at Cotopaxi since 2021, including the Director of Giving and Cause Marketing. Before Cotopaxi, Charlie worked across philanthropy and nonprofit partnerships and has a history of working with brands in the outdoors. Charlie's located in Portland, Oregon, and will be seen wheeling around a very pretty new roller bag next time you see him out in the airport. Charlie, thanks for being here.
The Carrazza. Yep. Awesome. Thanks so much, Neil. It was super fun.